This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. This week, I'm going to be talking about the new films Fist Fight, The Great Wall, A Cure for Wellness, 13th, and L. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course, the home cinema roundup with the 20th anniversary look at the Austin Power series. But before I do any of that, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
It's actually kind of a slow news week in entertainment. It's always a fast news week everywhere else. But since I try to, as much as I can, avoid politics on this show, I'm just talking about news. And it's actually been kind of slow. There's been no massive celebrity deaths, which is kind of a nice break, actually. I mean, there was all the hubbub about the Grammys. Here's the thing about the Grammys. I don't care about the Grammys. I'm not a music guy. I mean, I love music, but I'm not into the pop music. I don't care who wins the Grammys or not. I'm not even into the big stage productions, even though I can appreciate sort of like what Lady Gaga did on the Super Bowl halftime show. I didn't care to watch it. As much as I appreciate what Beyonce does in her live performances, I don't want to watch that. I'm bored with that stuff. I mean, I listen to music, but especially the soundtrack of my life comes from movie soundtracks and music that's been in movies. But apparently there was, a big hubbub where Beyonce should have won, but Adele won these awards and everyone, it was like, I literally was on Twitter at the time seeing people just losing their minds over this as if there was some conspiracy, a voting conspiracy in the Grammys. And how I actually saw somebody tweeting out about how, oh, let's, you know, somebody saying just like the election, how a woman wasn't chosen. It's just as, you know, how Hillary was not chosen as president. It's the same reason why Beyonce somehow is marginalized in record. Like it was almost became a race thing. And I'm like, oh yeah, cause black people never win Grammys. I mean, that's like never happened. I mean, they're completely shut out by this waspy group that votes on it. No, the problem is everything's subjective. Okay, so some people thought that Beyonce was better than Adele. I don't know. Is this worth getting upset over? It's not like Beyonce doesn't get her due. It's not like people don't respect her as a musician. So yeah, that's all I know about the Grammys. I just know that it caused people to lose their mind. But let's talk about a couple little news stories. They're smaller ones. One of them that really caught my eye this week is Mel Gibson is apparently in talks to direct Suicide Squad 2. Now, I did not particularly like Suicide Squad. I thought it was kind of a mess of a movie and kind of went everywhere. And I'm not a big fan of the director who did that. It's probably one of the films I liked of his more than other movies like Sabotage, which was terrible. But I gotta say, I'd love to see Mel Gibson do something like Suicide Squad, especially if they allowed him to release an R-rated Suicide Squad. Because Mel Gibson certainly can make R-rated action and visceral, powerful action. I mean, he say what you want to about him as a person. I know there's some people who carry a lot of grudges about him. I learned that you can't not like a director or an actor or performer because they could be kind of a jerk, because then you just wouldn't like any actor, performer, director. So I think Mel Gibson's a very talented guy. He makes great movies. I'd love to see what he did with the DC Universe and the Suicide Squad too. So that I'm really rooting for that. The next piece of news I saw, and this is just a little brief note, apparently Lin-Manuel, he's working on a Hamilton movie because, of course, it's money. Hamilton is the big thing now. Now, the one problem with Broadway is it's very fleeting. Hamilton is the biggest thing right now, but who's to say next year something else is going to be a new big thing? I mean, Hamilton's always going to get people coming to see it, But sometimes these juggernauts or apparent juggernauts in Broadway that hit the popular culture, the wide mainstream popular culture, they sometimes stick around for years, like Phantom or Les Miserables. But then there are ones that they may be around for many years but have a limited lifespan, like Cats. So you don't know how long this Hamilton buzz is going to last, so they're going to want to capitalize on it as soon as possible, especially now that musicals are doing well. You know, stuff like Into the Woods, and you have Les Miserables, and of course, La La Land, although that's not, I don't count that really, because that's not quite the traditional musical. The last piece of news I want to talk about is there's officially been a new actor cast as R2-D2. As many of you know, Kenny Baker, who had played him since 1977, had passed away this past summer. And I mean, he was like 81, so he had a good long run, and he was probably one of the more famous little people actors. But he was always sort of the heart and soul of R2-D2, and you can't just replace. A lot of people say, oh, it's just a trash can. But watch the original movie, and watch when they have just the robotic three-legged R2-D2 versus the close-ups. There's a certain personality that R2-D2 keeps, not just by the sound, which is done by another guy, but with his performance as the robot. And so the actor they're replacing him with is Jimmy V, who actually played R2-D2 in The Force Awakens. He didn't get credit. It was sort of an uncredited thing. But he's going to be the new R2-D2, and that's great. He's a Scottish actor. He's been in the Harry Potter movies, and he was in Pan, and apparently in Doctor Who. He was in the Titanic episode. He was the little red guy with the spiky head. Is the accent going to be a problem? I don't know. I mean, Kenny Baker was British. This guy's Scottish. I don't know. Is R2-D2 going to sound different? Who knows? You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to touch on is It Comes at Night. It's a horror film coming out August 25th.
We don't know what made Stanley sick. We don't know anything. Nobody touched him, so I think we're fine, right?
Positive.
You just opened the door, right? You didn't go in.
I didn't touch the door.
The door was already open when you got there.
Yeah.
Then who opened it?
If you're lying to me, I will kill you.
This is directed by the guy who did Krisha, which was a film that A24 released last year. And it was an interesting film because it showed a family exploding because of their wayward aunt or causing problems at a family dinner. And I think it actually ended up being one of John Waters' top 10 films of 2016. But this guy's now trying his hand at a horror film, and it looks creepy enough. It looks like it's playing off the feel you get with movies like You're Next or It Follows, this sort of very limited, scaled down vision of a horror movie. And even though it doesn't have the people who did like You're Next involved in it, it has that independent low budget feel that's actually got a lot of quality now, and it brings a lot of quality with it in the modern age. So I'm very much looking forward to that. The next one I want to talk about is the Lego Ninjago movie, which opens on September 22nd.
I'm taking the Salamol to form the secret ninja force. Are you ready to risk your life for Ninjago?
Yes, I am on it. Maybe.
It's okay, Lloyd. Nobody's parents are perfect.
I mean, my mom is weird and collects seashells. Your dad levels cities and attacks innocent people. So, they've all got their quirks, you know?
Of course, you would expect something like this to happen, because after the Lego movie, and now after the huge success of the Batman Lego movie, and I'm sure they saw this coming because this has already been in the works, and we got a trailer for this. In September, they're doing Lego Ninjago. And now, I mean, anybody over 20 or 25 probably doesn't know what that is unless their kids have played with the toys. And that's where it's going to see the rubber meeting the road. Can they expand this outside of the modern fan base? Because what made the Lego movie and even the Lego Batman movie work so well was that they were properties that people knew outside of the people who played with those toys, or either they played with them when they were kids or they're just familiar with them, like Batman. We'll see if Ninjago actually works and can actually expand the fan base. It's not going to make $50 million its opening weekend, but I mean, for a September release, I don't think they're expecting massive profits, but it looks funny. It has the same tongue-in-cheek feel. So if you like that from those other movies, this should be enjoyable. That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Fist Fight and L. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about some movies to review. The first one I'm going to talk about is L. And that's actually not a new movie. I mean, it's not like one that's releasing this weekend. I mean, maybe in your city it's been in limited release, but it had a slow rollout. It's a foreign film. And the reason I'm talking about it is, especially this week, and I'm going to see that with 13th, which is another movie I'm going to review this week that's a little later in the show, I want to cover some stuff that's up for Oscars that hasn't gotten covered that I really haven't had a chance to talk about. And L's one of them. It's a foreign film directed by Paul Verhoeven. And it stars Isabelle Huppert as a woman who is an independent businesswoman and in France. And she is sexually assaulted in her apartment. There's a break-in and she's sexually assaulted. And it's her trying to deal with all that and the fallout from that as she continues through her business and her life. Now, it's in French, so that's why there's no trailer for it. Because, I don't play foreign language trailers on this show. But it's significant to talk about because she's nominated for Best Actress Oscar. And if there's going to be an upset right now, I mean, leading into this, it was kind of assumed that Natalie Portman was going to just straight out win the Oscar for Jackie. And she's done extremely well for herself over the course of award season. And yeah, there's maybe a little bit of competition from Emma Stone. And the fact that Amy Adams isn't up for a rival, then that sort of shortens the field. But the reality is that if there's anyone who's going to really do an upset, it could be her. Because she's been getting a lot of notice for this, and she does a fantastic job acting. Now, when it comes to the film, it's Paul Verhoeven, who's best known for movies like RoboCop and Starship Troopers, and these, Total Recall, these big action movies from the 80s and 90s in America. And then when he finally fell off the radar, when he was making movies like Showgirls, that kind of ruined his career. And he had other movies like Hollow Man. He started to fall apart as a director. He went back to Europe. I think he's Dutch. He went back to Europe to continue to direct movies. And he's played with a little bit more serious dramas and more intimate dramas. And they're still a little bit hardcore at times. Obviously, this one is completely wrapped around a sexual assault. So that's not a surprise for Verhoeven, but he deals with more character studies. And it's an interesting character because she's a cutthroat business person. She works at a video game manufacturer or developer, and she has to deal with the people under her and the people working with her. That's a challenge for her. Now, the movie itself deals with a lot. It deals with her relationship at work. It deals with her relationship with potential suitors. It deals with her relationship with her neighbors. And it's an important look at a modern, complex woman. And in that respect, it's totally worth seeing. It is also very European. It's very heavy. There's a lot of moral relativism in there, a lot more than you see in an American drama. In American dramas, the things are very cut and dried in a lot of ways. And in a movie like this, you're going to have whether or not she's even going to admit it to some people and whether she's in danger of it happening again. The other problem I had with it is it does try to be too many things. It is trying to be this look at her as a professional. It also is trying to look at her as the would-be sexual assault victim and how she deals with that and how she deals with herself sometimes as the worst enemy in whether or not to report it and whether or not to look like a victim. It offers a lot of things to consider. So, not my cup of tea, not exactly my kind of movie, but like I said, she does a fantastic job acting in it, And it's worth seeing, if for no other reason than to just sort of like complete your slate of Oscar films to see. So I'm going to have to say that in the end, L kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Fist Fight. This one stars Charlie Day and Ice Cube. A mild-mannered English teacher finds himself under fire when a history teacher in his broken school challenges him to a fight after the final bell rings.
911, what's your emergency?
There's a crazy guy at my high school. He's trying to beat me up.
If you have a problem with a bully, I need you to speak to a teacher.
No, I am a teacher.
Excuse me?
It's actually another teacher
who wants to have a fist fight
with me after school, so I need help.
Why? Are you trying to pick a fight with me, man?
You ratted on me.
He did it.
Now you got to pay the price.
On the surface, this has some very funny moments. I like Ice Cube in comedies. I like Charlie Day. I think they're both funny and they work well off each other. I mean, Charlie Day is basically, he's sort of like a white Kevin Hart in some ways, because Kevin Hart did so well with Ice Cube doing the Ride Along movies. And there are funny moments. In fact, some of the funniest moments come from the supporting cast interacting with Charlie Day. But the big problem this movie has is it doesn't fully commit to the uproarious, raucous comedy. It's like they're 90% because it's the last day of school. This is a terrible school system. The students are disrespectful. They're abusive. They're destroying property. They're trying to do pranks everywhere. You've seen in the trailer, they let a horse loose in the hall. They drive a car through the wall. I mean, they have all this stuff that's just insane stuff. And the principal and the staff are all insane people, but they have this weird thing where somehow it's trying to work the story in and shoehorn it in. And if you've ever spent any time, my wife's a teacher, so I tend to know a little bit more about how schools work. And so they're like firing people on the last day of school. I mean, you never fire people. You never pull them in your office. Oh, Kenny, hey, leave your class. Let me come here. You're fired, by the way. Go clean out your desk. They don't do that on the last day of school. That's not how it works. Plus, there's apparently no teacher union to deal with the stuff that's going on here. There's no contracts that the teachers have. They're just firing willy-nilly, whether they like the person or not. And they like have the superintendent coming in and doing the firing. I mean, it's just weird stuff that doesn't really work. And yeah, I know I'm nitpicking on that. But the other problem is, I think they're trying to make a message to this. You know, Charlie Day is this mild-mannered guy. He's the only nice guy in the school, even like the Ice Cube. I mean, he's a rage-infested crazy man in this movie. The stuff he does, you're like, okay, I can see where, you know, being a teacher to this high school would get on your nerves. But some of the stuff he does, you're just like, you should go to jail for some of the things you're doing. And it's kind of like this message of stand up for yourself. Don't let bullies pick on you. But you can't go into a fist fight and get a brain concussion just because you don't want bullies to pick on you. It tries to give this weird message of standing up for yourself, but wrapped around this context that everybody's insane. And a situation like this should be like, no, you need to get out of that school, and that school shouldn't work that way. And by putting that message in there and trying to ground a character, it just makes everybody else look more insane, and then they don't do anything with the insanity. On top of that, it's sort of like trying to make a point about education. And I'm like, well, you know, this thing hasn't worked the way an education institution in America actually worked. You could make a point. That's the problem. And I've seen movies like that happen. I saw TV shows. Like, I remember watching Arrested Development. You have these characters and they're terrible people. They're horrible people. And then from week to week, they would, at the beginning of the show, they tried to make them grow and change, but you don't want them to grow and change because you got to come back the next week. In the Charlie Day show, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, they've hit a stride because they've learned don't make the characters grow or get better, because then you have to deal with a better character in the next episode. You wouldn't have anything funny. And so that's kind of what gets in the way of this movie. They either needed to fully commit or they could have dialed it back a little bit. And that was my problem with it. So, I mean, for a lark and a funny movie, sure, why not? But ultimately, I got to say Fist Fight kind of sucked.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Great Wall and A Cure for Wellness. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews. Let's start off with the latest exciting movie that was made for a Chinese audience, but it's just getting released in America anyways, and that is The Great Wall. Matt Damon stars as a traveling mercenary who stumbles onto the Great Wall of China and the creatures that attack it while on a quest to obtain black powder.
Why are you here?
We came to trade.
You lie. You are thieves.
What was that? There are many things you have not seen.
The Great Wall is the only barrier keeping the world safe.
This first hit my radar when people started to complain about this being a whitewashed movie. The fact that it's a big movie that takes place in China on the Great Wall and the star is Matt Damon, who's not Chinese. And it brings up some of these concerns that we see when you have something like 47 Ronin, which is really about Keanu Reeves, who's not Japanese, and his character is made up and inserted into this legend of 47 Ronin. You saw the same thing with The Last Samurai with Tom Cruise. It was a movie about samurai, but it had Tom Cruise in it. Well, this is something Hollywood has been doing since the 20s, ever since they've been making motion pictures. I mean, going back to Charlie Chan, you know, they had white people playing Charlie Chan in yellowface. And in fact, one time when they had an Asian actor playing Charlie Chan, it didn't do well. People, in general, the mainstream likes to see themselves in the movies. And so making a movie that has all Chinese people in it for a big budget and then having them talk English and have some language barriers, it doesn't always work. But they put this character in there, and I think it's fine that, you know, now that I've seen the movie, I'm like, okay, it works because he's a traveler. He's sort of like the audience surrogate and brings you along. But it's directed by this famous Chinese director, and it stars a lot of Chinese actors, well-known Chinese actors from China. They're really not known in America. You know, it's not like they put like Jackie Chan in it or Jet Li. Those are well-known American stars, but now. But I'm fine with this because it kind of works for what it is, but it's so obvious that they're just releasing it in America. It's not made for an American audience. It's made for a Chinese audience. It's all about Chinese history and the wall. I'm putting history in air quotes here because it's really not about history, because the wall was not built to keep out giant dog-like lizard monster creatures or anything like that, which is what they are in this movie. But it's made for China, and it's going to do incredibly well in China. It's going to probably be one of these movies. It's going to be like Warcraft, where it's going to make 10 times that in the international market because of the Chinese the marketplace. China is a huge evolved marketplace now for movies, and movies are made, and sequels are made simply because of how well something did. Look at Pacific Rim. We're getting Pacific Rim 2 simply because of how well it did overseas. It didn't do terribly well in America. Now, with that said, this feels like a Chinese movie. I've seen enough Chinese movies that it feels like a Chinese movie with these Americanized European characters just shoehorned in awkwardly. And what you end up with is all the Chinese actors don't speak English. That's not their native tongue. And a lot of times they're speaking, I believe, Mandarin to each other. But the ones that do speak English, it's a little choppy because that's not their native tongue. And they should have just made it with Chinese people and forgone these European characters, because that's not really what the movie's about. The movie's about what's going on with these people on the wall trying to stop these monsters from attacking the capital and killing the emperor. That's the story. But the white guys just get in the way. And on top of it, it's weird because Matt Damon does this strange Nicolas Cage kind of accent through the movie. I mean, he talks like this all the time. I mean, it's a weird accent. And the delivery of the lines are so stilted and so bad. I mean, some of the dialogue is really terrible. Maybe it worked. It would work better in Chinese, but it's terrible in English. And some of the delivery, especially by Matt Damon and the girl who plays the general, that he is, of course, she's gorgeous, you know, their dialogue is stilted and boring and terrible. And then the effects aren't very good, actually. I mean, it's got a lot of visual effects in it. I mean, it's almost like a Lord of the Rings kind of movie with the battle sequences where it's all CGI. But some of the things they have, like these mechanisms they have on the wall, are nonsensical. You think, well, that's not the smartest design you're ever going to see. And that certainly ends up getting a lot of people killed. And the first half of the movie is just them chatting a little bit and then being attacked, and then chatting a little bit and being attacked again. And not a whole lot happens. I was bored with this movie. It looks cool at times, but it feels like there was that movie Dragon Wars that came out about 10 years ago, which was a Korean movie that got wide release, and it had these dragons in it and had American stars in it and that sort of thing. But it just felt really low rent. And in a way, as big of a movie as this is, it does feel kind of low rent. So I'm going to have to say The Great Wall kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about A Cure for Wellness. Gore Verbinski directs this thriller about a young businessman who travels to Switzerland to try to bring the CEO home, but gets caught up in the treatment issued by a mysterious wellness center.
I'd like you to go to Switzerland and bring Mr. Pembroke back to us.
What we offer here is a process of purification away from the pressures of the modern world. Welcome back, Mr. Lockhart.
Signs of concussion, depleted immune system. I would like to recommend a treatment.
Think of it as a cleansing of the mind as much as the body.
This is a tragic movie. And I say that actually in the literal meaning of tragedy. Because Gore Verbinski is a brilliant director. He's got a great vision. And he's very talented, and he's given some really neat movies. I mean, not just the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, but I thought Rango was cool, The Ring was good, even The Weatherman, which just wasn't very well received. That was a really good movie. But he has some tragic flaws. And like many directors, he tends to go a little long. And you saw that with the Pirates, the first three Pirates movies, which he directed, whereas the first one was really streamlined and felt good. Second one was a little bit bloated, but it was fun. But the time you got to the third pirate movie, oh my God, that was like 3 hours long, and it didn't need to be. And this movie's like 2.5 hours long. And I took my son, and I said to him afterwards, I asked if he liked it. He said, yeah, I thought it was okay. And I said, they could have lost about 45 minutes in the middle. And I'm not kidding about that number. I honestly think this movie, if it had edited out 45 minutes, it would be a much better movie, because the whole visual style is amazing. I mean, it looks gorgeous and it looks creepy, and it all plays off this old sanitarium thing. Sort of like if you watch, I'm not a big American Horror Story fan, but if you remember the series Asylum, where they're in an asylum, I love those kind of settings. You got all this old equipment and it looks antiquated and it's very creepy, and you feel like you're go in there sane and you'll come out insane. And that's the feelings that this evokes. And so the look and the sound design and the music all works towards that. And there's a story, and there's a story that needs to be unraveled, and the mystery that needs to be unfolded. But it folds it over and over and over again in the middle, and it just doesn't need to do that. It really could have been tightened up, because the opening 20 minutes or so, really solid. The last half hour ain't bad. I mean, it could be a better ending, but you know, it's kind of cool. It's a cool ending. It's just that after waiting for 2 hours already, you're getting to that ending, and you're like, okay, just get it over with. So, as neat as it is, and how many good things there are, it has that tragic flaw of being bloated and overlong. And that's a Gore Verbinski thing. And this might end up being his downfall in general, is this guy needs to start to learn to edit his movies down. Maybe in script stage, he needs to start to do that. I'm still going to give it a kind of rocks, because I thought it was at least mildly entertaining, and there's a good movie in there. It just, there's a lot of other stuff that you don't need. So I'm begrudgingly a Cure for Wellness kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about 13th, the weekly box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring a look back at Austin Powers. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies for the final segment of the show. Let's talk about one more movie. It's not a new movie. There's a couple reasons why I want to cover this one, and that's 13th. The first reason is because it's nominated for an Oscar, and I never had a chance to talk about it earlier. It's nominated for a documentary Oscar, and those tend to slip through the cracks. So by the time they nominate the Oscars, they've already been out, and it's not like in theaters right away, so it's kind of hard to talk about. Well, this one is, it's a Netflix documentary. So if you got Netflix, you can watch it. Anybody can watch it. It's on there now. You can hit play right now. And it's directed by Ava DuVernay, and it's about the Black experience. And it's still February, so it's Black History Month. So there's several different reasons why it's good to talk about this one. So let's take a look at 13th. Director Ava DuVernay takes a look at race relations in America since the abolition of slavery and how the prison system continues the practice of free labor.
One out of four human beings with their hands on bars, shackled, in the world, are locked up here in the land of the free.
The 13th Amendment to the Constitution makes it unconstitutional for someone to be held as a slave. There are exceptions, including criminals.
The loophole was immediately exploited. What you got after that was a rapid transition to a mythology of Black criminality.
Ironically, I just recently reviewed I Am Not Your Negro, the film that deals with some of the writings and topics of discussions from James Baldwin. And if you recall my discussion of that movie a week or two ago, is the first, like, 20-30 minutes are a bit scattershot. They're kind of all over the place. And he's talking about a lot of different things and not really making connections. And then it kind of becomes more focused once he starts really getting into civil rights and the image of privilege and culture and Black people in cinema in particular. This movie is kind of the same way about that first 20-30 minutes. This movie it can be very scattershot. I'd heard that it's about the 13th Amendment, and it's really not. The 13th Amendment abolished slavery. But that's just used as the jumping off point, because the point that the movie's trying to make is that the Black man can still be enslaved if they're in prison. Of course, there's a lot of white people and Hispanics and others that are also enslaved under the loophole in that amendment that says that you can be in slavery, basically, unpaid workmanship if you've been convicted of a crime. And there's a lot of good points that are said. The problem is it heaps so much on that it's overwhelming. And to the point that some of the stuff, it just becomes a pile on. Like, one of the things they do, they talk about politics throughout the ages, and they talk about how presidential politics has victimized Black people and used them as a stigma. And it goes back to the Willie Horton campaign against Mike Dukakis by George H.W. Bush. And yeah, I mean, I guess that was used in there, but I think if you put a meth head character up there and you called him Jimmy Horton, and it was a white guy who looked all, you know, strung out and white trashy, and he did the same thing Willie Horton did, yeah, I think people would be equally annoyed and outraged by that. I mean, I think it's laying almost too much weight on that one political ad. And it talks about the exploding prison population, and it ties it to crack. And of course, a lot of that's blamed on Reagan. But you have to look at it and say, well, hold on a second. If you didn't want crack dealers and crack addicts were in fact committing crimes, and crack was a bad thing, and there was a crackdown, no pun intended, and was it done perfectly? Maybe not, but when you talk about prison population, it's there's a second side to it, and it's saying, well, it's a big prison population, and there's a lot of fathers in prison, and you're like, well, but if they've committed violent crimes, they should be in prison. And I think you can make cases that they don't in this movie, but you can make cases for there are certain crimes that maybe the punishments are too high. Mandatory minimum sentencing, I'm all for, as long as the mandatory minimum sentencing isn't for something stupid and it's not a ridiculous, you know, 30-year prison sentence for an ounce of marijuana or something like that. That's a little overboard. And I think they need to have realistic goals. And so it does become a scattershot. Whereas when she did her movie, Selma, which is a beautiful movie and great, it's very contained because it's about that one moment in Martin Luther King's life. This movie, you're talking 100 years of history and slavery and prison and the image of the black experience and how civil rights worked. There's so much there that it just becomes this pile on, and you either start just accepting everything they say because you're exhausted for thinking critically about it, or you just start rejecting everything they say because they're piling on. And there's things throughout that I personally think were a little overstated or didn't give a very good perspective. So I'm still going to say it kind of rocks, but you got to watch it with a critical eye.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. I said that the Lego movie was going to do $60 to $80 million. The original one opened with like $72 million. The Lego Batman movie did $53 million, which that's nothing to be ashamed of. Part of the reason I think it had a softer weekend is it was also working against John Wick Chapter 2 and 50 Shades Darker was also, there was a lot of stuff going on this weekend. I mean, you look at the top three movies this weekend, it's like $130 million. That's a huge number for just the top three. And they're all new movies. And that's with 50 Shades Darker coming in with about half of what the first film made over its opening weekend. So Lego Batman did really well. John Wick did just about $30 million, which is actually a little more than I said. I said 25 to $30 million. And that's really good. So you're going to get a third John Wick movie. You're also going to get another Lego Batman movie. And I guess they're just going to finish up 50 Shades because that still did well because they didn't spend much money on it. This week, I think you're just going to see a repeat with Lego Batman, because I think it's going to be good for 35, 40 million maybe, because it's still going to play well. And then The Great Wall is going to be less than 20. You know, it'll probably be just in the top five. Fist Fight, I don't think it's going to do terribly well. It might end up with the same ending weekend number as Great Wall, but it'll be seen as a hit because it didn't cost much to make that, and The Great Wall costs a lot more. But then it's got to open in China and make $1 billion. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The first thing I want to talk about is I want to look back at Austin Powers, because it's the 20th anniversary of the first film's release this summer and the 15th anniversary of Goldmember this summer.
In 1967, an international secret agent was cryogenically frozen in case the world ever required his services again. Now, evil is threatening the Earth, and the time has come to bring him back into the 90s. It's not
unusual. Allow myself to introduce myself.
Danger Powers, personal effects.
Actually, my name is Austin Powers. Danger's my middle name.
Anyone who knows me or has listened to the show, they know that I do movie marathons with my family. We do 24-hour horror movie marathon, and in the fall we do a 24-hour sci-fi marathon in the spring, and we do other movie marathons throughout. I've shown all the kids the Bond movies, and 5 years ago we watched all the Bond movies. So I've recently rewatched them. I've started watching them again. I watched like Dr. No and From Russia with Love just recently. I like to watch it every 5 to 10 years. And then I wanted to watch Austin Powers. I wanted to show my kids Austin Powers because I'm like, oh no, you need to see these because now you can see where all the jokes came from because you've seen all the Bond movies. And we're in a post Mike Myers world where Mike Myers isn't the star that he used to be. And that's because partly started with The Love Guru and Cat in the Hat. I mean, he did some really terrible Adam Sandler level things, but he hasn't done much lately, but Austin Powers is a hoot. It still holds up. It's funny because it's 20 years from the first movie. You're talking about 1997. That doesn't seem too far away for me. 1987 is a little farther, but you know, in 10 years, you can do an Austin Powers movie where Austin Powers goes forward another 30 years. It's still relevant. The 90s has its foibles and its pop culture references, but the 90s still work as a riff point. And the same thing with the Spy Who Shagged Me, which was the second one, and then Goldmember. It becomes very clear that the first movie was unique and clever and original and cool, and the second movie was just an excuse to make a sequel. And they put a little more thought into the third movie. And the third movie doesn't hold up as well, but it's still a funny movie. The first one is still sort of that gold standard, and it's a great spoof of the spy genre, and it's neat to then go back and watch Dr. No and From Russia with Love and Goldfinger, and which is what I'm kind of rewatching now. So, looking back at the Austin Powers movies, I did have a lot of fun rewatching them. And, they've been in deep freeze for long enough. Pull them out and watch them again. They rock.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Just a real quick list of the other movies that are out on DVD now. You can get The Edge of 17, a brilliant movie, a really good movie about teenage growing up as a teenager. Bleed for This, about a boxer. Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. And then Star Trek Enterprise, the complete series. That does it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Collide, Get Out, and Rock Dog. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.